This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Questions to anyone or all three, right in the centre there.
Okay, hello. Yes, I'm Paul Cole from the University for the Creative Arts. I wanted to ask a question about the theme of the conference, Investing for Greatness. Can the panel comment on the focus on STEM subjects and whether sufficient investment is being made in the creative arts? Especially given the significant contribution of the creative industries to the UK economy and the potential of the UK to be a leader in the global digital economy.
David, would you like to go first?
Didn't someone claim that one year the export earnings of the Manic Street Preachers were higher than British Steel? And there are those kind of statistics around which do bring across your point very powerfully. Yeah, I think that the creative industries are clearly very important. Without getting too far into my obsession on teaching, I would say that it's probably in the... If you look at what appears to have happened on sort of time and intensity of academic contact, it looks as if the changes in the past 10 or 20 years, sometimes sadly for the worse, have been more on the humanities side, whereas the number of hours that students on STEM subjects get as academic contact and the kind of intensity of the teaching is very much what it always has been. So my focus on teaching and putting resources into teaching is partly aimed because I think that's where the humanities have been particularly vulnerable. And I also think that the complementarity of STEM subjects and, well, humanities, social sciences, more widely is very important. And to give you a particular example, up at the University of Central Lancashire, now in the Northwest, nuclear is a big issue, and the University of Manchester are leaders in sophisticated nuclear technology. But I'm told that building the technology you need for building a power station is now pretty widely known, and that isn't where the challenge lies. At the University of Central Lancashire, they have got a fantastic kind of epidemiological research sort of resource. They've got the health data for people who've lived by windscale going back 50 years. It's one of the biggest, longest sets of data of people exposed to or living close to a nuclear power plant anywhere in the world. They are in researching that to see what the health risks are. And they say this has now become an international market for them. Whenever there's a public inquiry around the world and pressure groups are saying this is going to increase cancer rates, one of their academics goes and gives evidence about what their research shows. So there is a complementarity between what happens in the arts, humanities, social sciences, and STEM subjects as well. And so I completely buy your point that we must not forget, particularly... the creative industries. And if you've got any ability to check that statistic, which is at the back of my mind, but I haven't checked, and if you've got ones like it, I very much suspect J.K. Rowling is up there with Britain's leading manufacturing industries. I think they should be, that should be recognised and celebrated in a reminder of the economic impact that creative industries make.
Nigel, do you want to comment?
Really, literally, just a comment. On STEM subjects, it's important, it's necessary, I think, to privilege them in various ways, but it has a corollary, at least under the current situation, which is that there is a squeeze on the arts and humanities and social sciences, which is, if anything, I suspect, likely to increase in the future. So there's a kind of contradiction at the moment, which I think we do need to think quite seriously about.
From our point of view, it's crucial that the arts and humanities are funded properly in this country. But there is a false distinction between STEM and the creative industries. They're not two different things. I mean, you can't exist in the digital world as a creative person these days without also being very knowledgeable about, you know, the how the digital world comes about. Bits and bytes are as part of the digital world as much as product. And even in the old days, if you're in the BBC, you know, it was stuffed full of engineers. The place couldn't work without engineers. So I think there is a false distinction, but I think it's a good corrective. We have to absolutely keep our focus on the cultural implications of things in this country as well as their economic implications.
Right. Further question?
Hi, I'm Ellie Sample from Oxford Brookes University. And my question is, I do some focus groups with students and before they come, and they often talk about their concerns about fees. And obviously you're aware of corporate universities like Microsoft setting up, and aware of the fact that universities have delivered education for the same way for the last 200 years, really. And I read recently that Don Searle said that Google are closer to the future of higher education than higher education is. Do you think that's true?
You want to start again?
I think there is something in that. It was my sort of straying into I Choose You. And I do think that it's that there are very big issues there. And the sheer power of sort of accessing resource on the internet is quite extraordinary. And it's a pity that it often appears in academic debates as the great plagiarism problem. And I came across a really imaginative approach to that the other day, where someone was saying, look, don't think of it as how do we punish plagiarism. No, plagiarism doesn't have to be punished. Think of it as, are we properly training young people in how they acknowledge sources, in how they produce what, in my old-fashioned way, I think of as footnotes, how they acknowledge the research literature they've drawn on, which often for an undergraduate course is actually something that should be, that is celebrated, it's something that academics look for. And you suddenly, and if you turn this round, instead of raiding Wikipedia for some text, instead go onto the net and then acknowledge what you have found on the net and properly acknowledge it and footnote it and make it, use it in a proper academic way. That's just one tiny example. And I think there are clearly stages of learning where the individual, be it through visually watching a recording of the lecture. Some universities with their visa problems this year have had to record all the lectures so that when the Chinese students finally arrive, they can catch up. Either that or studying directly on the web, I think it is indeed the future, yeah.
I don't think Google is actually the answer. I mean, Google's a brute force search engine. You know, it's dumb. But the internet isn't dumb. It's full of 2 billion people talking to each other. So the future, it feels to me, will be not Facebook, but interconnectedness. And when Web 3.0 emerges, which is around what's called the semantic web, where it's about meaning rather than search, I think that's a big challenge going forward. And I think actually that's going to be hugely beneficial for students and for teachers and for researchers globally. So no to Google, but yes to the internet.
Actually, I don't think universities have been teaching the same way for the last 200 years. and indeed, certainly in the last 20, 30 years, they've added an enormous spectrum of different ways of teaching to their armoury. So I think that's the first thing I want to say and to underline. I don't think they're conservative in the way one might actually take from what you're saying. Going on from that... No, I don't think that these things will replace universities. I think what will happen is that they will make universities richer places to be in terms of the kind of learning environments that will be possible. But in the end, a lot of teaching has to be is a way of showing people how to do things, and that cannot, I think, be taught at a distance in very easy ways. And in fact, most of the successful things which have been happening in terms of IT are so-called blended learning of one form or another, where you have a mixture of face-to-face learning and distance learning, where you use IT in various ways and such like. And I think that's probably going to be the future, but not just IT.
I can take one last question over here, and then we're going to have to break.
Thank you. Mark Brather, Scottish Funding Council. A quick question. Do the panel think that we have enough accredited work placement as part of our overall academic offering? And if not, what do we do about it?
David, do you want to start again?
Well, I certainly agree that we do not have enough of those accredited work placements. What I'm going to learn from our other two panellists is what we should do about it.
That sleight of hand. Nigel.
Well, thank you for that.
First thing to say to that student's work, Very large numbers of them do. And it's often depicted as though somehow the other, they're all working in bars and burger joints. And that's absolutely not true. In fact, it's impossible. There wouldn't be enough of those jobs, presumably. One of the things that quite a lot of universities are doing at the moment is trying to formalise some of this work experience in various ways and add it in, if you like, to the overall university experience. For example, at Warwick, we have a thing called Unitemps, which actually works as a company to find temporary jobs for students and actually thinks very seriously, therefore, about the kinds of things that they might be doing when they have to work. So that's the first thing to say. Second thing to say, in terms of work placements more generally, it obviously depends on the degree, but I don't think there's any reason why most students couldn't do some kind of relevant work placement, and I don't think it would necessarily be a bad thing. The problem is finding enough placements. Whether one likes it or not, that is an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. And that probably does, in the end, require something, I have to say, closer to a national solution than what we have at present.
As I said earlier, I've been to a lot of universities recently. A lot of them are trying to do this. And Plymouth, where I was on Monday, although it seemed to me took 2 days to get there, is absolutely accrediting every student who does either workplace or, more importantly, in a way, volunteering, because there's a massive tradition of volunteering down there, so they'll credit the volunteering work that they do as well as a work placement. But I think that's a challenge back to business. I think as business leaders say consistently that they want students to come out who are almost work-ready, you know, in a way that none of us in this room ever were, I think that the challenge back to business is, well, fine, but you've got to take people in and you've got to help us train them, and then we will accredit them with you. And then you'll get somebody coming out the other side who's got more of the softer skills that you require. And one of the things at CIHE we consistently say to business is, if you want this, you have to make it happen.
Well, on that note, I think we can carry that idea forward to the session after the break. But meanwhile, I think we should show our appreciation to the whole panel and particularly to David Willetts. Thank you very much.
Thank you.